Peterson Air Force Base, Colorado Springs, Colorado, December 27, 1999. Around 20 Russian soldiers arrive at the second floor of Building 1840, a U.S. Space Command office complex inside the facility. They occupy a stuffy, windowless room stuffed with dozens of desks, computers, and monitors, and a large video display in the front. Also, one red telephone connected in a secure line to Russia. At this very moment, approximately 2,440 nuclear-tipped American missiles are primed and ready to launch at a moment's notice. In Russia, 2,000 more are pointed in the opposite direction. Both of these countries have decades of experience building, pointing, and threatening to launch rockets. This time, though, they're extra worried that somebody might just press a big red button. And they have a good reason to be. 15 miles southwest of Peterson Air Force Base lies a dark steel tunnel leading directly inside of a 10,000-foot-high mountain. Burrowed inside of this mountain, through a military checkpoint and behind the giant steel door, lie top-secret operation centers for the Air Force and North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, plus a command and control center and an ultra-sophisticated missile detection system. Thanks to decades of Cold War, America's turn-of-the-century network of satellites, radars, and sensors can detect a Scud missile firing off from well over 20,000 miles in space, then instantly feed that data to operators at Cheyenne Mountain. Millions and millions of dollars have gone into building, modifying, and keeping this system up to date and resilient to small bugs. Russia, by contrast, does not have quite as sophisticated a system, and they haven't fully invested in updating it. For this reason, both Russian and US leaders are worried about an imminent, potentially catastrophic situation. At the stroke of midnight, on December 31st, 1999, as Russia enters its next millennium, there exists a non-zero chance that its missile detection system could glitch or fail in any number of unexpected ways. Such an occurrence could inspire what the Pentagon's joint staff call opportunistic engagements, mistaken or malicious interpretations of the false data, which Russian agents might respond to by actually launching missiles. Hi, I'm Ran Levy. Welcome to Cyberism's Malicious Life. Eight months before Space Command welcomed Russian troops to Colorado Springs, a reporter for the Baltimore Sun took a two-hour drive from Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, to visit a large house on top of a cliff overlooking a lake. Inside of this hilltop home lived an old, charismatic, surly, legendary computer programmer. He's not like normal people, one friend warned the reporter. He's eccentric, but bright as hell. Upon arriving, a quick tour of the house confirmed as much. Quote, there's his obsession with lists, page after page, detailing every country he's ever visited, every flight he's ever taken, complete with latitude and longitude of the destination and total miles, and the date of every visit to his parents. There's his bedside collection of 40-year-old Pugger Possum comic books. My hero, he says with a smile, whose nuggets of wisdom he likes to quote. His favorite, Pugism, the depth of human stupidity, are as yet unplumbed. There are his scrapbooks, overflowing with yellow newspaper clips and fading inter-office memos documenting a half-century at computer giants such as IBM, GE, UNIVAC, and Honeywell. End quote. Robert Beamer was born in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, in 1920. He earned degrees in mathematics and aeronautical engineering as a young adult, then took on a series of rather odd jobs. First, he was a machinist, then a furniture maker, even a movie set designer, before being enlisted to work as an aerodynamicist for the Douglas Aircraft Company during World War II. He worked for the Rand Corporation, Marquardt Aircraft, then Lockheed Martin, until in 1955 he landed as an assistant manager of programming research at IBM. And that's the least important part of his resume. In 1960, he was part of the committee which created ASCII, the character encoding format which remains ubiquitous today. He's been called the father of ASCII, in fact, for his role there, and for having invented a number of characters we take for granted today, like the backslash, curly brackets, and the escape key. So you can thank Bob Beamer the next time you use escape to exit out of an annoying program. He also developed a business programming language equivalent to Fortran, called Comtran. Then, as a member of CUDASIL, the Committee on Data System Languages, he integrated elements of Comtran into what would become COBOL, a 65-year-old programming language still widely used in mainframe computers today. It was his magnum opus. It was also, in some ways, a catalyst for an issue which would only rear its head four decades later. Bob may well have been the very first person to discover that issue, thanks to none other than the Marmon Church. Working for IBM in the late 50s, he was put on a job helping the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints computerize all of its reams of genealogical records. It sounds easy enough, but in the process, he ran into a technical roadblock. The records dated back hundreds of years, but he couldn't actually reflect that in the data, because in the format he was working with, years were only represented by two digits. The reason for that traced back to pre-computer times, even as far back as the late 19th century, when people used to use electromechanical equipment and punch cards to record their data. Punch cards survived the times. IBM computers still utilized cards with space for 80 characters. Over time, the inherent limit on how much data could be recorded by these machines and on these cards inspired the people who used them to come up with every creative means they could to abbreviate. Dates were an easy one. 1957 could easily be represented as 57, and you'd save on two characters. That doesn't sound like much today, maybe, but it represented 2.5% of an IBM punch card. This was the case even if you were working with cutting-edge digital memory. We're in 1957 now, but even years later, punch cards will still be around, and computer memory will be so expensive that it's hardly preferable. Take 1963, when leasing just 1 megabyte of mainframe storage cost around $175 per month. That's $2,100 a year, and remember, we're talking in 1963 dollars. Accounting for inflation, in 2024, it means that 1 megabyte of memory cost the equivalent of $25,500 per year. Let's fast forward through a dozen more years of technological advancement. In 1975, Hewlett-Packard ran an ad for a 30% price cut on RAM capable of storing 8,000 words. A paltry figure to us today, of course. What was the new low price of this budget offering? $990. And that was for bulk orders of 50. If you wanted just one for yourself, it actually cost $1,500, down from its prior price tag of $2,150. $1,500 in 1975 is equivalent to around $9,000 today. So how much money did it save to chop the 1/9 of dates? Two researchers did the math in a 1995 article titled "Accurate Saving of the Year 2000 Computer Date Problem." Quote, "Depending on the industry and application, about 3 to 6% of the data stored in organizational databases is dates. using four-digit rather than two-digit year fields would have required 33% more storage for dates. Using the lower 3% figure for date density, we conservatively estimate that 1% more disk storage would have been required through the years if we had stored all four digits of the year field. 1% doesn't seem to be very much until you consider several important factors: the large volumes of data stored by organizations, the historically high cost of storage, and the rate of inflation. So for every gigabyte of organizational data stored, a 1% saving represents 10 megabytes. Designing systems to save 1% of storage costs since 1963 have saved between $1.2 and $2 million per gigabyte in 1995 dollars. End quote. From this perspective, it feels like programming computers in the 1950s to record four-digit years would have been outright malpractice. Before the Senate Banking Committee in 1998, then Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan reflected on this, admitting that, quote, "I'm one of the culprits who created this program. I used to write those programs back in the 1960s and 70s and was proud of the fact that I was able to squeeze a few elements of space out of my program by not having to put a 1-9 before the year. Back then, it was very important. We used to spend a lot of time running through various mathematical exercises before we started to write our programs so that they could be very clearly delimited with respect to space and the use of capacity." End quote. It totally made sense to cut off the 1-9. On the other hand, there was Bob Beamer, trying to computerize Mormon ancestry records in the late 50s, failing to distinguish between people born in 1950 and 1850 or 1750. IBM's own fault. "It was the moment of awareness to me," he told the Baltimore Sun. "I realized that using two-digit years wasn't going to hold up. It was a ticking time bomb, and as one of the pioneers of business computing, he'd been complicit in building it. Now he would have to defuse it before it was too late." To be fair, though, he did have 40 whole years to work with, more than enough time to fix everything with decades to spare. Right? The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. And so to reduce costs and headaches, small businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial, management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required and accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/malicious. That's netsuite.com/malicious. netsuite.com/malicious. Not long after the Mormon incident in the 60s, the U.S. government recruited Bob Beamer to a committee alongside a few dozen other computer experts and tasked them with creating standards for the entire industry. It was as yet a nascent industry. Only a few thousand or so computers existed in the entire country, which was already far more than any other country. But this was still urgent work, since prior to this point, there were no common rules for engineers to follow. We complain sometimes about interoperability today, but in the 50s, everyone did things however they wanted. going from one system to another must have been a nightmare. Beamer was perhaps partially responsible for that mess. His baby, COBOL, universalized business programming, but it also had an opposite effect. Being so user-friendly, with simple human-readable commands, it opened up programming to, as he told the Washington Post, any jerk. "I thought it would open up a tremendous source of energy," he recalled in 1999. It did, but what we got was arson. In the face of everyone's bespoke, incompatible software and hardware, Beamer and his colleagues created things like ASCII and other common coding standards, which became utterly foundational to computing to this day. But not all of the committee's ideas were equally successful. One task it took on was to decide how computers should represent dates. Beamer, keenly aware of the problem posed by centuries, knew that they needed to implement a four-digit system, even if it came with significant costs. And by this time, he wasn't the only one who knew that. Besides the Merriman Church, there were at least a few organizations which used four-digit years for computerized record-keeping because they needed to account for the pre-1900s. The Veterans Administration, which represented plenty of former soldiers born before the century mark, did it. The Smithsonian needed more characters than anyone to distinguish centuries in BC and AD. So Beamer and a colleague proposed standardizing the four-digit year. They could save on BC and AD. The thing is, most of the world's computers were being run by the US government, and most of the US government's computers were being run by the Department of Defense, which had a different view on the matter. "We would have to change every stinking file," Bill Robertson, the Director of Data Standards for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, told the Washington Post decades later. "We would have had a revolt." Not only were all of the DoD's programs already using two-digit years, but they already had a system for accounting for the century. Robertson had helped develop and implement it during his time in the Air Force. Besides the day, month, and year, there was an optional element in the system for indicating which century it was. It was flexible, so that anyone could save space or provide the extra information as needed. Overhauling their systems would have been time-consuming, costly, unnecessary, and risky, since they handled top-secret files and, you know, missiles. They rejected the four-digit proposal. And so, on November 1st, 1968, the National Bureau of Standards, known today as the National Institute of Standards and Technology, published its Federal Information Processing Standards Publication 4, formalizing the two-digit year under Section 4.1. The standard became a requirement for U.S. government agencies beginning on January 1, 1970. Try to remember that date. It will be relevant in our next episode. Following the government's example, and with an eye to being compatible with its systems, most computer companies adopted the two-digit standard. Beamer lost his fight, but he still knew he was right and that the consequences could be dire. He just had to convince everyone else of that. He wrote to the American Medical Association and politicians and stormed into the offices of the Postmaster General. In the February 1979 edition of Interface H, a computer magazine, he wrote what might have been the earliest published story on a coming millennium bug, warning that, quote, "there are many horror stories about programs working for years that died on some significant change in the date," end quote. He even got his message to the White House, or rather the science advisor to the president. "I discussed it with my staff," the advisor told the Washington Post, "but they and other agencies," quote, "wagged their heads sagely and said this problem is simply not on the radar screen. It's 30 years in the future. We'll be out of office. Leave it to these civil servants. They'll still be here," end quote. Eventually, Beamer gave up. In 1982, at the age of 62, he retired. 14 years passed, And then, one day, Bob picked up a copy of the Wall Street Journal. A headline immediately stuck out. Businesses make a date to battle year 2000 problem. As he remembered, quote, "I read that and reread it and reread it again and said, my God, they didn't take my advice."
We'll talk to Microsoft about some reported Y2K problems with Windows, and we'll search the web for good and bad information about what you should do to deal with Y2K. Plus, we'll look at the mainframe side of the problem. Can you count on power, water, money, and safe air travel on January 1? Also, my pick of the week.
January 1st, year 2000. Power's out. It's pitch black. You need light. If you planned ahead, you'll have one of these. Call now and get the ultimate Y2K survival kit from BeCalm.com. You'll receive the Sunburst, the premier
Y2K. Is the government prepared to handle the potential disruptions presented by Y2K? How about your local utilities? Will there be ample supplies of food and water for you and your family? Will it be business as usual at your local bank, or should we expect some problems, such as restrictions on cash withdrawals? And how about emergency services and law enforcement? What are they doing to prepare?
Our total staffing complement between 7 o'clock this evening and 3 a.m. is 892 police officers. Some of those officers...
The situation, the ramifications of what year 2000 means, then hopefully there won't be a panic, because the problem is that nobody really knows what's going to happen, and it is such a large problem.
Call 1-800-303-8747 now and tell the operator to rush an ultimate Y2K survival kit to your home. Call now.
They're coming for it. Your personal data, your intellectual property, your business. Cyber attackers are working to take what belongs to you and holding you to ransom. Defenders don't fear ransomware. They end it. With CyberReason, defenders detect and stop ransomware that even others miss every time. This is not just a product. It's a mission. CyberReason gives you the upper hand against ransomware and all other cyber attacks. At CyberReason, we don't fear ransomware. We end it. Learn more at cyberreason.com/ransom. One last thing before we go. I want to introduce you to Perry Chen, who in 2014 began collecting books, media, and other cultural remnants left over from the Y2K scare.
You know, I went into the investigation myself as a person who lived through it. I mean, I was young, but I lived through it. I think I was kind of like in my early 20s.
Today, Perry's best known as the founder and former CEO of Kickstarter. For our purposes, though, he is most relevant for his Y2K exhibition, Computers in Crisis, in New York City's new museum. You can check it out at computersincrisis.com. Among all of the silly survival books, government records, conspiracies, and events he recorded, Perry noticed a strange pattern to what happened just after the millennium turned.
And as I investigated this, because I was so intrigued by the fact that we went through this kind of very strange and very loud, very alarmist period, that I kind of wanted to like look back at it, because it was this thing where it's like we all decided, or basically the people with the microphones, the press and the government decided that like right after it happened, like to never speak of it again.
It was like a giant cover-up without any need for coordination or even stating it out loud.
And so I was like, this is fascinating. Like things that are 1/10,000th of the size of this get postmortems. And yet this thing, the biggest story of the years leading up to the millennium, literally, like it is like people want to pretend it didn't occur.
Y2K is really only ever remembered today as a joke. Some of the reason for that is that nobody wanted to talk about what happened after it was over. And part of the reason is that few people actually understood what happened that day. It's still a source of debate, in fact, how serious the millennium bug literally was. Was it way overblown and not actually a problem to begin with, like most people now believe? Or was it only stopped thanks to the hundreds of millions of dollars and thousands upon thousands of hours of effort invested into preventing the worst possible outcomes? In our next episode, Bob Beamer develops a solution for how to prevent a Y2K disaster, the Americans and Russians team up to stop nuclear launches, and much more. Civilization, as we know it, doesn't collapse, but it does change in some major ways. And it also fails to account for a second Y2K-style bug, one which is now just 14 years away. That's it for this episode. Thank you for listening. Not a lot to say this week, so we're moving straight to the credits. Malicious Life is produced by PI Media. This episode was written by Nate Nilsson, edited by me, with sound design by Shelley Guetta. Did you know that all of our episodes have full transcripts on our website, malicious.life? Or did you know that you can invite me to give a talk about many of the topics we covered in the podcast, such as the Kevin Mitnick story or Stuxnet, for example? You can reach out to me via email at ran@ranlevy.com, that's ranlevy.com, or Twitter at ranlevy, or LinkedIn, Facebook, etc. Thanks to Cyber Reason for underwriting the podcast. Learn more at cyberreason.com. Bye-bye. CK Music.